Hello and welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies. I'm Michael Morales, your host. Today's program will be speaking with David W. Stowe about his recent book, Song of Exile, The Enduring Mystery of Psalm 137, published by Oxford University Press in 2016. Song of Exile weaves together the 2,500-year history of one of the most famous psalms in the Hebrew Bible. It examines the entire psalm, including the more obscure last stanza, and it draws on historical and interview research with musicians who have used Psalm 137 in their music. David Stowe earned his PhD from Yale University in 1993. He is currently interim chair of the English department at Michigan State University. During the 2012-13 academic year, Stowe held a research fellowship in music, worship, and the arts at Yale's Institute of Sacred Music. Among his other books, he wrote No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music, and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism, that was published by University of North Carolina Press in 2011. He also wrote How Sweet the Sound, Music in the Spiritual Lives of Americans, that was published by Harvard University Press in 2004. And that book won the Dean's Taylor Award from the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael. I'm really looking forward to this.
So, David, tell us a little bit more about yourself before we get into your book. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a town outside of New York City called Tenafly, right across the Hudson River, and basically spent my life up and down the East Coast. I went to college in Pennsylvania, worked for a while in Washington, D.C., did graduate study in Connecticut, and then got a job out in Michigan, where I've been ever since, a very happy transplant to the upper Great Lakes. So I am a musician. My research and teaching and scholarly writing has been mainly about music. Started out writing about jazz and have moved into books on religion and music, sacred sound of various sorts, but I continue to be a musician. I play drums and saxophone. I just played a gig last night. So I feel very fortunate to have a research field where I can think about music and sort of immerse myself in something that's been a love of mine for my entire life.
Now, what first sparked your interest in the Psalms, and in Psalm 137 in particular?
Well, I have been thinking about Psalm 137, actually writing about it now for over 10 years, Michael. I first became aware of the interesting musical history of Psalm 137 when I was writing my first book on American religious music, and I talked about the psalm a little bit in the introduction, and came back to it a couple of years later. I was part of a team that was pulled together to work on a book on religion in the Caribbean, religion and music in the Caribbean. And this was a project pulled together by the founder of the Black Music Research Center in Chicago, Sam Floyd. And so as I was thinking about how I might contribute to that, I became aware that Psalm 137 by the Rivers of Babylon has this really important, interesting history in reggae music. And probably the most famous popular music version of the psalm came out of Jamaica and has been covered many times. So it seemed like, wow, that would be an interesting text to explore and sort of trace the kinds of social political meanings it's had around the world. So I started with a fairly limited North American perspective. I became aware that the great American composer William Billings had adapted the psalm in the Revolutionary period, sort of using it as a patriotic song against British domination. And I knew a couple of the other versions, but as I dug further and further, I realized that, I mean, the psalm was everywhere, and it didn't make sense to just look at it from the North American context. I wanted to give a broader sense of the meaning and significance of the psalm around the world, which involved tracing it back to the Middle East and to Europe, where it's played a really important role over 2,000 years in Christianity, as well as Judaism. So what began as a paper or a book chapter expanded. I was finding more and more material, and it seemed like it would actually be a great candidate for a short book. And I was able to get a research fellowship at the Yale Institute of Sacred Music, which was really invaluable because it gave me a year to broaden and expand and deepen my research, especially on the original context of the psalm, sort of 6th century BCE Judean Babylonian context. And so I was able to really read widely. And as an Americanist, American studies scholar, obviously this was a very far removed field for me. So I in a book on a 9-verse psalm is probably enough. And so I kind of wrapped it up. But, you know, I continue to come across new stories about the psalm, new musical versions. So it seems to be a sort of ongoing, continuing project.
For those in our audience not familiar with Psalm 137, summarize its basic content for us and then explain the historical context of this psalm in ancient Israel.
Right. And one thing I found in doing this research, Michael, is that after a while, when you're working on a project, you assume that everyone you talk to has heard of Psalm 137. And then I had to continually remind myself, no, this is not common knowledge. But when I mentioned some of the famous lines from the psalm, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps on the willows in the midst thereof. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? That's the opening of the psalm, more or less. And so it's the only psalm out of 150 Hebrew psalms which has a particular setting, a particular time and place. Other psalms refer to various historical events, but in a more generic sense. You don't have a sense that they're being placed at a particular location. But Psalm 137 is. It's narrated the opening by a river in Babylon, a group of Judean captives who are mourning and are being taunted by their captors, the Babylonians, who are taking them into exile, who ask them, you know, sing us one of the songs of Zion. You know, a sort of taunting request. And the Judeans ask themselves, you know, how can we do this? How should we do this? Should we even sing? So the events are very historically specific. The Babylonian captivity stretched over about a 50-year period. There were actually three exile movements of Judeans taken from the area around Jerusalem and taken up to Babylon, which is off to the northeast. And so this was part of a move by Babylon to create a buffer state between its own position in what is now Iraq. Okay, that's where Babylon is. Babylonia. And so they had an interest in Judah as a territory which was adjoining and could create a kind of buffer zone between Babylon and Egypt. So they didn't really have great designs on the territory. But there was resistance from the Judeans. The Judean kings basically resisted this kind of subjugation. And so various contingents of royals and priests and other social elites were taken from Jerusalem to Babylon in three different waves, and basically taken into the court of Nebuchadnezzar. So they were not treated poorly. They were just, it was part of the strategy of keeping the enemy or keeping the potential enemy close. So the king Jehoiakim was kept at court. He was treated very well, and he's mentioned as eating at Nebuchadnezzar's table. So you've got this population of Judean elites living in exile in the court, and then you've got a larger population of more ordinary Judeans who stay in Judah. I mean, they're really of no interest to Nebuchadnezzar. So these are people referred to as people of the land or the galut, and they stay behind. But there's continuing resistance, and another king in Jerusalem basically refuses to accept Mesopotamian domination. And finally, Nebuchadnezzar has had enough and goes in and lays conquest to Jerusalem and destroys the temple and puts the king and his sons to death. And so this is a more sort of harrowing destruction. And so this is the memory that is referred to in the second section of the psalm, the sort of nostalgic longing for Jerusalem and this sense of great violence visited on the sacred space of the temple.
So as your book title suggests, this psalm is a song of exile, of people longing for their homeland. Is there any hope in this psalm as well?
Yeah, there's a hope. The second section of the psalm is about sort of forcing memory, holding the memory of Jerusalem close, and you know, vowing not to forget Jerusalem, and a sense that there will be a return. And then the final section of the psalm takes a more violent turn and sort of engages in a certain amount of violent fantasizing about the punishment of the Babylonians and the Edomites who assisted in the destruction of the temple. So there's really three distinct sections of the psalm. Even though it's very short, it's nine verses. It has some different voices, different modes of address, and really different moods. So it's a rich document, and it sort of captures a sense of the immediate location, but also the need to remember and the need to look ahead to the future and some sort of a divine retribution, divine judgment against people that have destroyed God's chosen people.
Your book is divided into three major sections: history, memory, and forgetting. And those are the three movements you find in Psalm 137.
Yeah, that's right. I decided to divide the book up that way. And I was inspired by the great French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, whose last book was called His Memory, History, and Forgetting. And I meditated with that book and sort of thought about the different sort of categories of experience that the psalm captures. And so the first section of the book, part one, deals largely to lay out the historical context of what's happening in Babylon and around Jerusalem, and what different books of the Hebrew Bible say about this experience. And it's sort of amazing how much of the Hebrew Bible is really influenced by, is really a kind of response to the trauma of the exile. So that's in part one, under the title of history. Second part, memory, deals with this oath of memory that the psalmist takes to not forget Jerusalem.
really interesting way my right hand is cunning made my tongue my mouth. I met the archbishop. So the psalmist is actually sort of enforcing his own memory. Okay? And it's an interesting concept because the evidence from the Hebrew Bible and elsewhere really shows that the Judean elites up in Babylon were not really treated badly. And if anything, there was a kind of danger of assimilating and losing this connection to the homeland. And so there's a sense, there's a kind of division between Judeans who stayed behind, who looked with some disfavor on the elites who seemed to assimilate up in Babylonia. So the issue of memory becomes very important. And then the third section of the book, forgetting, really deals with the issue of, you know, what do we do with the violent rage that comes out of these sorts of historical traumas? And there have been, as you know, a whole succession that have affected Jews over history, most recently, of course, most infamously in the Holocaust. So issues of memory, forgetting, and forgiveness, and ways in which the sort of challenge that the psalm lays down is very much on the minds of people in the present day who are dealing with mass atrocity and forced migration on really a daily basis around the world.
The trace echoes of Psalm 137 throughout cultures of the world like Korea, Cuba, Ireland. This is a monumental task. How did you go about your research?
Michael, it was a great experience in the sort of cumulative riches that come out of a research project and the sort of body of scholars that are out there who know bits and pieces of the Psalm 137 story, musical examples. And so over this period of 10 years, I was the beneficiary of all sorts of helpful advice from other scholars, from ministers, from lay people who knew these songs. And of course, the riches of the internet make this kind of research a lot more accessible and convenient. And so I really stumbled on quite a few versions through very mundane means like Google searches. Believe it or not, I'm not ashamed to admit that I got a couple of good leads from Wikipedia. You know, 'cause that's exactly the kind of source where, you know, people weigh in and you're likely to hear from someone who might not have any scholarly publications, but they have a very interesting sort of anecdote or an obscure reference. So as far as tracing it through the different national and ethnic groups, I would stumble on different books and articles. I mean, I did find some really good ones during that fellowship year at Yale. And just became aware that this psalm has been much favored and a sort of galvanizing message for lots of ethnic groups in America, immigrant groups who left the homeland, felt that they were in some sort of exile in North America, and retained this sort of nostalgic longing for a homeland. So, you know, the book that deals with the Irish experience and music in North America actually includes, you know, How Shall We Sing the Lord's Song in a Strange Land in the title. I mean, there's dozens of books out there that use some version of that line, or by the rivers of Babylon. So I can't even begin to remember where all these different leads came, but I mean, just the full range of research possibilities.
David, you mentioned in your book how some have drawn analogies to the Cuban exile, to give one example, and that seems especially relevant inasmuch as Fidel Castro has recently died. Can you discuss that comparison for a moment?
Yeah, I thought Cuba was a really fascinating analogy, and I really based my discussion there on the work of a couple Cuban American theologians who really worked it out in some detail, and one of whom a feminist theologian had actually left Cuba about the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. From a sort of upper class family, had come to North America thinking it was a temporary move, that Castro would have been deposed and she would have been allowed to return. But as time went on, she realized, wow, no, this is my new home. This strange land is my home. And so it became a very kind of personal psalm of longing for a country that she didn't really choose to leave. She was a young woman at the time. But I think the analogy really works because there are three elements. There is the population that stays behind in Cuba as the majority of Judeans stayed behind in Judah. Then there's this smaller group of elites who are forced out of or who escape from Cuba at the time that Castro rises to power. And there's a great story about some of these folks leaving Cuba in their tuxedos and cocktail dresses on New Year's Eve because they realized they had to get out quickly. And then the third element that makes the analogy work is the presence of this large sort of looming imperial force to the north. Okay, so the United States, like Babylon, it sort of welcomes the elite Cubans who come to America and looks out for their interests, but there's this kind of tension between those two populations and a certain amount of resentment from the Cubans who stay behind, who have to struggle under the conditions of American hegemony and the challenges of a sort of chaotic and uneven economy, and also the sense that the people who left, first of all, they carry their privileges with them, and they think of themselves as the sort of saving remnant of Cuba. And I think a certain amount of trepidation that when the communist regime is finally ended, those Cuban Americans will simply come back and reassert their status. So there's lots of national groups, ethnic groups, where you have exile, where you have forced migration to a new country and this nostalgic longing. But the dynamic between the Cubans and the Cuban Americans, I think, is quite unique and really fits the circumstances of the psalm quite well.
Thank you. That's good. What are some other ethnic or cultural appropriations you can highlight for us?
About the Irish and also the Koreans. Koreans have who are the most Christian population in Asia. So there's quite a bit of Christianity in the Korean population, as well as among Korean Americans, as well as Buddhism and other religions, of course, but this sense of being displaced, of populations moving to Hawaii as laborers, and eventually some of them moving back to Korea, others continuing on to the West Coast. I think in the case of the Irish and the Koreans, again, there's an interesting dynamic where you have peoples that sort of exist and fight for their sovereignty in the shadow of major imperial powers, right? So for the Irish, there's this presence of the British, who are occupiers and colonizers for hundreds of years. So there's this kind of resentment of Britain. I think for Korea, the analog would be another island nation, Japan, who establish dominance and annexation of Korea. And so there's, again, the sense that there's this oppressive power close at hand, which is driving populations to these strange lands, to these foreign lands, in order to, you know, establish a more secure existence. In the African American church and in African American politics more generally, going back to Frederick Douglass, who chose the Psalm text for the centerpiece of probably his most famous single piece of writing, What to a Slave is the Fourth of July, which he delivered in Rochester, New York, and makes a very strong case that the enslaved Africans and the free Africans in America are in the position of the Judeans, who are being basically coerced and mocked and oppressed by the United States. And so why in the world would they celebrate the 4th of July when the ideals of that holiday are perniciously being violated in their own experience? And so the psalm has been picked up in the Black church by Black preachers. Frederick Douglass himself was not a minister, but it's one of the texts that has really inspired, generated some amazing preaching, probably most famously by the great Baptist preacher C.L. Franklin from Detroit, who was probably the most visionary. Martin Luther King said he was his favorite preacher, and he preached a great sermon on the psalm, asking the question, you know, should we sing, right, in this strange land, and answering it affirmatively that, yes, it's our obligation to sing as an expression of freedom and determination to rise above racial oppression in the United States. So C.L. Franklin made a great version, and it's figured among a lot of other preachers. Jeremiah Wright, who became famous during President Obama's first run for the White House, became very controversial, but a leading minister in Detroit, had a very powerful sermon, really narrating the side of the Babylonian captivity from the book of Daniel, because after all, Daniel is a Judean who is taken in by Nebuchadnezzar's court and sort of stands up to the king and sort of through his powers of dream interpretation is able to establish himself in the court. So Jeremiah Wright gives a really interesting sermon, again, a kind of analogy amid oppression, where people are being asked to take different names and to forget their language and to forget their religion. And he says in that sermon, but the Babylonians went too far when they asked the Judeans to give up their religion, because they had the audacity to hope. The religion gave them the audacity to hope. And when I read that line, I realized, wow, Barack Obama could well have been sitting in that church. This was a church he attended in Chicago. And it wouldn't have surprised me. I wasn't able to confirm this, but that phrase, the audacity to hope, lodged in his memory at that point. And of course, that became the title of his second book. If I could mention one more example, back to Jamaica and the Rastafarian religion and the reggae music that came out of Rastafarianism. This is a place where you find the concept of Babylon acquiring a great deal of significance. Babylon becomes a symbol of oppressive power, whether racism, colonialism, economic oppression. So anyone who's listened to any reggae music knows that Babylon figures in song lyrics and song titles. And so it's fitting, I think, that probably the most famous popular music of the song came from this Jamaican group, the Melodians, who were an early sort of pre-reggae group that that made this song. And it starts out, I think a lot of people will have heard it, but by the rivers of Babylon, where I sat down, and yea, we wept when I remembered Zion. Okay, and it goes on from there. So that's a song that found its way into the soundtrack for The Harder They Come, the great reggae, great film starring Jimmy Cliff, who plays a sort of Rastafarian bad man in Jamaica. And that film really, I think, helped create a national audience for Americans for reggae music. And so I think that was the first glimpse and the first sounding that lots of young Americans got of this new musical form. So I think those are some different examples. North American, Caribbean, but you can find the Psalm being taken up in South Africa, other liberation movements around the world.
That broad cultural reception is amazing. The subtitle of your book refers to the enduring mystery of Psalm 137. Why do you think this psalm has had such an impact?
I think the emotional range that the psalm moves through in just nine lines, the sort of emotional range that it covers, from sort of the sense of betrayal and confusion and dislocation, the opening of the psalm, to this sort of commitment to remember, to hold on to one's religious and cultural identification in the face of forces that are aiming to dissolve that sense of identity. And then finally, the sense of kind of violent rage, indignation, bordering on violent rage. You know, how can these people get away with it, right? How can they get away with this horrendous deed, which is not just a crime against the Judeans, but against Yahweh himself? I think that range of experience is very much a universal experience for people who have, as many people around the world over history have experienced, forced migration and dislocation. So there's a kind of universal quality to the range of pain and anger and resoluteness that can come out of that sort of experience. So I think we live in the age of migration and exile. We're seeing this in Syria and Turkey and northern Iraq. I mean, it's a huge historical force that's changing the world from Europe to North America. And so, you know, the patterns may be accelerating, but that's always been the experience of great masses of human beings. But the other thing about the psalm is it's got some beautiful, memorable lines. You know, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. Okay, so a very, very clear image. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? Right? I mean, that one line itself, I think, captures in a very poetic metaphor the sense of struggle at holding on to one's identity, one's sense of a homeland in a place that seems to be pulling one in a completely different direction. And that's a sense of a dilemma about, do we accept the new conditions? Do we sort of look to the future and this new existence, or do we look back to the past? And I think that oscillates, right, in people's experience.
In your epilogue, I thought this was interesting. You note the hope offered by the subsequent psalm, Psalm 138. Can you give us maybe a word on the relevance of Psalm 138 for some of these themes that you trace in Song of Exile?
Yeah, I used to get questions about, what comes after Psalm 137? And I always interpreted that to mean what happens historically. And, what happens historically is that the Persian, Cyrus, the ruler of Persia, invades Babylon, and he quickly defeats Nebuchadnezzar, takes control of that empire, and releases the Judeans to return to their homeland. So there's this return and this need to kind of reestablish religious and political structures in the homeland. Someone finally explained, well, no, what happens after the psalm, as in the next psalm? So I finally caught on that they were asking about Psalm 138. And, it's the psalms, as you know, Michael, have a range of emotions from, absolute jubilation and sense of an immense gratitude towards God, a sense of triumph, to psalms that really explore, the depths of human suffering and alienation and misery. So I thought it was interesting after a psalm that ends with this very striking image of blessed shall he be who taketh and dasheth the little ones against the stones, meaning the infants of Babylon, that you have an opening line: I will praise thee, O Lord, with all my heart. Boldly, O God, will I sing psalms to thee. I will bow down towards thy holy temple. For thy love and faithfulness, I will praise thy name. For thou hast made thy promise wide as the heavens. When I call to thee, thou didst answer me and make me bold and valiant-hearted. And then the psalm ends, the Lord will accomplish his purpose for me. Thy true love, O Lord, endures forever. Leave not thy work unfinished. So it's a reminder that after oppression and rage and violent fantasies, there's a different mood. There's a sense of peace and blessing and a sense of rightness in the world. And you find that kind of movement consistently through the Psalms, right? So they provide, as John Calvin said, a kind of anatomy of the human soul. And so I was really struck by the juxtaposition of a very lamenting, angry psalm next to a kind of sense of almost euphoric peace.
Yes, the shaping and formation of the Psalter is a fascinating study. Well, David, you mentioned in your book that you have a link for this book, some resources available on your personal website. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Very glad to do that, Michael. As someone who writes about music, I've seen the technology just really explode and transform what can be included with books. So it's no longer the question of do you include a CD with a book, but the website really makes it a whole lot easier. So I created a website with images and video clips and sound recordings of the psalm, many of the examples that are discussed in the book and many others that are not discussed. And the website is very easy to remember. It's simply my name, davidwstow.com. And that website will get you right to the book. There's a few other things listed there, but I really created it as a sort of companion for this book. So find those materials, and they're organized according to the three parts of the book, so you can follow the logic of the examples.
Excellent. Well, David, it's been great having you on the show. Maybe before we let you go, can you tell us about any other projects you're working on?
Yes. I am taking a slight break for the time being from academic, and I'm actually turning to a novel that has been on my back burner for several years. I didn't always know it was going to be a novel. I thought it might be more of a memoir, but it is going to be a work of fiction. And I've got a working title for it. It's called Learning from Loons. And it is a book about family life and a marriage and the effect of that marriage on children within a nuclear family and an extended family. But it's also got some reflections on the bird, the common loon, which is a kind of, I think, powerful symbol of lots of things in American culture, but has a kind of special place in the lives of these characters in the novel. So it's been really fun to kind of shift gears and get back to a type of writing that I haven't done really for a long time since I became a scholar. I expect I'll pick up some new projects in American sacred music. One thing I'd like to sort of develop that I had to leave on the cutting room floor, so to speak, of Song of Exile was some reflection on the psalm and its place in the Axial Age, right, which is a very interesting period of time that's been written about by Karen Armstrong or others. But this is a period about 500 BCE when simultaneously around the world, very important thinkers, philosophers, and religious folk were basically laying the groundwork of the world religions. So this is the period when the Buddha lived. This is when the Greek philosophers were writing. And I thought it would be interesting to kind of look at Psalm 137 and the exile more generally, and how that exile experience example of axial age thinking. So I've got some good material. It will not be a book, but I'd like to develop into some kind of an article.
Sounds like you've got good work ahead of you. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Michael. It's been really great to talk to you.
We've been talking to David Stowe about his book, Song of Exile, The Enduring Mystery of Psalm 137. Again, that's published by Oxford University Press in 2016. You can find a link to this book on our website. Thank you for listening in. Until next time, goodbye.